You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia. Today we are in Salerno.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Ok. It doesn't look like anything's broken for now, but we're going to check in this evening and then we'll make a statement this evening. But for now, we've nothing else to say. Thank you.
Well, Brian, buonasera. Good evening from Salerno. The voice we heard there at the start of the episode was Phil Lowe, the Sudal Quickstep press officer. There was a lot of kerfuffle, as you can imagine, around the Sudal Quickstep bus this evening. And we went back to the press room pretty much empty-handed, apart from that statement that Remco Evenepoel was going to be checked over tonight. Of course, he's, well, multiple crashes, two crashes. They are the story of the day, really, aren't they? As well as Caden Groves' victory. But Brian, first of all, how are you?
Well, thank you, Daniel. Well, you and I were probably one of the few men who didn't crash today. Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. We're in it's just like the bustle, hustle and bustle of Salerno here, ordering an aperitivo because we're recording
lovely
this quite
falangina.
Exactly, a local white wine. But we are recording this quite late today because it was
there's a lot to get through.
Yeah, there was
falangina. Incidentally, there is a falangina on our Girovagando selection available from Divine Cellars. You can find information about that on our social media channels, divinecellars.com. Brian, we've seen a lot of water today, haven't we? Almost as much water as was on the water menu in the restaurant we ate at yesterday. A bit of a fancy restaurant, wasn't it?
Not a particularly pleasant way of fancy.
No, it wasn't a particularly dining experience, but yeah, there was a water menu, two pages. And the funniest thing about it was they were very run-of-the-mill mineral waters, most of them.
Yeah.
Some of them at extortionate prices. And there was all sorts of statistics listed alongside the different waters, things you really didn't need to know, the sort of temperature at which they were extracted and so on and so forth. But yeah,
I would have liked the executive water summary, so just didn't have so many to pick from.
Yes. But Brian, you mentioned that a lot of riders struggled to stay upright today. We are in Salerno, and Salerno, not too much of a rich cycling heritage. Not many of the cities down south are. However, there is a significant link between Salerno and the Giro d'Italia. There have been stages here, of course, in the past. Your countryman and friend Rolf Sorensen won here in the 90s. But one of Salerno's most famous sons was a writer and poet called Alfonso Gatto, and very famous, won lots of literary prizes in Italy. He covered the Giro d'Italia in 1947 and 48, shared a car with Vasco Pratolini, another extremely illustrious Italian writer. And Alfonso Gatto was extraordinary among Giro d'Italia journalists. Why? Because he couldn't ride a bike. In fact, this was his first piece. I'm just going to read a couple of lines from his first piece in 1947, just as he was about to embark on his first Giro d'Italia. I'm going to let you into a secret. I must be the only journalist here who doesn't know how to ride a bike. Shame on you, you'll say. I've been telling myself the same thing long before today. But what a boon it is for our newspaper. I'll be able to share every one of my emotions with you in servizio esclusivo, my wonderful events and incidents that my colleagues won't even take seriously, and my unvarnished awe for those blessed boys who'll be able to fly on two wheels, as though on the wings of angels. Well, a lot of the riders in the Giro d'Italia, 2023 Giro d'Italia, were flying, but not in the way that they would have liked today.
No, all kinds of crashes, and we'll probably going to talk about that potentially also in the next couple of days, because it doesn't look like the weather's going to be a lot better.
It certainly doesn't. And Brian, I should also have said, Alfonso Gatto. Gatto, of course, means cat. We're going to talk quite a lot about pets, animals, domestic animals, in this episode for reasons that will become clear any moment for those who haven't already seen the stage. Brian, I think it's time for the tale of the tapa.
It's time for the tale of the tapa.
Away you go, Brian.
Thank you, Daniel. So stage 5 of the Giro d'Italia, 171 kilometers from Atripalda to Salerno here on the Mediterranean coast. It started in very rainy conditions and the weather predictions weren't very optimistic for the rest of the day. Three riders didn't have to worry about that, and those were Valerio Conti of Coratec, who was did not DNS today because of a hip fracture yesterday. The two other non-starters were Raymond Simkeldang of Alpecin de Koenig and Remy Rochas of Cofidis. Four riders attacked from the beginning. It started with a pretty hard climb, and one of those four riders was Thibaut Pinot, and he was there for the points. The three other riders were there for the breakaway. So once that was established, all hell broke loose. There was a very early crash, actually for two riders in the breakaway, Martin Marcellucci of Bardiani and Stefano Gandin, who's been very active so far in this race for Coratec. But very early, so 20 kilometers into the race, a crash caused everyone to hold their breath. A dog, what looked to me to be a corgi, caused a crash of several riders, and one of them, who ended up sitting on the road for quite a bit, was Remco Evenepoel. And you and I were driving into Salerno just as that happened, and we were quite worried that that would actually be the end of the Giro, because it took him quite a while for him to get up again. But eventually gave the thumbs up to the Rye cameraman, and a bit of a sigh of relief for all of us. It would have been a real shame. So with the three guys up the road, it wasn't really to be a successful breakaway. It looked quite early as if Trek, DSM, who were doing the bulk of the work, getting a little bit of help from Sudal Quickstep as well. They had a clear intention to keep the breakaway in check. And at some point, actually at 82 kilometers to go, the trio only had a minute and a half. With that situation, I think everyone was sort of pretty content to let the other teams do the work. The last attack came from Samuele Socerato of Bardiani, but with 25k to go, it was sort of at the end of the road for the breakaway. However, they did sort of give him a little bit more, a little second lease of life. But just as he was about to get caught with 7k to go, there was another even bigger crash, and lots of riders went down, including some of the favorites, amongst them Roglic, Geraint Thomas. And we sort of thought, well, okay, now they will probably get reorganized and riders will fight to get back. They weren't going that fast paced, and it actually seemed like there was a group that basically got away after that crash. But with just after 3 kilometers to go, another crash, and that was actually almost only Remco hitting ground at this point. And my theory is he was slowing down because he passed the 3 kilometer sign. He wanted to stay out of trouble. He swerved a little bit to the left, didn't stay in his line. And behind him came Alex Kirsch, who tried to avoid him, but eventually just clipped him from behind. We can talk about whose fault it was, but I'm not too sure that Alex Kirsch can be faulted for that one. Relatively small group to fight it out for the stage win. Caden Groves did a smart thing in moving to the right, staying away from the wind off the coast, and that actually meant that Mads Pedersen got blocked in a little bit. Stage win to Caden Groves, Jonathan Milan second, Mads Pedersen third, and a very, very spectacular, and I don't mean that in a good way, crash on the finish line, where Mark Cavendish's rear wheel slipped, and he went first to one side and then to the other side and actually tumbled across the finish line. So that was the tail of the tapa. I was quite keen to get confirmation for the GC, and no one of the guys in the top 10 lost time today, so also a sigh of relief after such a crash marred stage.
Well, Brian, it was an extremely eventful day. I was down at the team buses. I saw Alex Kirsch. You talked about his role in Remco's second crash. He tried to pay a diplomatic visit to the Sudal Quickstep bus, and he was sort of sent away, not because anyone was particularly upset with him, but they sort of said, I guess he was there to apologize, or at least to see that Remco was okay, and he was sort of sent away reassured. He seemed to be reassured anyway that everything was okay.
And that's quite standard. I've even overheard in the press room that, he went to apologize, and it's not always you go because you see someone crashed and you were somehow part of that crash. So I think it's quite normal that you go and check up on that rider. I mean, they're competitors, but they're also colleagues. But I actually think when Remco looks through the footage, he was visibly very angry, and you couldn't hold that against him. That was when you crash twice on what you think will be a relatively easy stage for him, at least, then of course he gets upset. But I think once he calms down, he'll, and obviously once he knows that he's okay and gets the confirmation from the team doctor, I think he will be okay with Alex Kirsch as well.
Yeah, we heard some rumours, didn't we, in the press room this evening that they might be going to the hotel for checks. Not sure if that's the case. Remco, I saw him come in. I would say the mood around the team bus was one of slight concern rather than great alarm. There were still sort of fist bumps and, you know, he still took the time to have a quick debrief with his coach, Kern Pelgrim. And as far as, well, visible damage, there was a little peephole in an unfortunate position just in, on his backside. But that was about it as far as sort of torn lycra was concerned. He was quite lucky, or he was quite wise to that. He was pretty well wrapped up early in the stage, wasn't he? Certainly.
Yeah, it was.
And consequently, the crash or the injuries maybe weren't as bad as they might ordinarily have been.
But also, when you think of it, This is the most important race of the year for Evenepoel, and thus the most important race for his team. And the minute something like this happens, everyone just stops, and you get this scare because you're all the hours and all the investments, everything they put into this project, you get this sinking feeling that, oh my God, is it just going to end like this? So it's a very tense moment for a team when something like that happens.
The Cycling Podcast at the 2023 Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
The Cycling Podcast coverage of the Giro d'Italia is sponsored by Science in Sport. And during this Giro, we've been talking to their riders about their fueling routines. And I wanted to know from Ben Swift what his thoughts were in any given stage. How does he plan his fueling throughout the course of the race? We often hear from the sports directors that the basic information they're giving to the riders is to remember to eat and drink. It sounds really obvious, but in the intense heat of racing, it's the first thing that gets forgotten. So what is in Ben Swift's mind when he rolls out of the start, and what is his nutrition strategy in the race?
Generally with me, because you need to, it's about consistency. And just the way that I have my sort of like Garmin set up where I can look at stuff, I generally use the map page so you can see what's coming. And then I have like the power and distance. So instead of using sort of like time, I use like the distance of sort of like every 15K trying to, depending on how the fueling strategy is, but if it's high, try and do that. But then if I know there's a big climb coming up, or you almost have to fuel for the demands that are coming up. But as a general guidance, I'll use that 15K as a marker because I know that'll be roughly every 20 minutes. But if it's a more intense day, sometimes you can't. And that's when the different products come into hand. You know, if it's, let's say, crosswinds, for instance, it's going to be near enough impossible to eat. So you take more of the high carb drink, or then you take more of a gel base, you know, where it's like, it's easy and quick to get it in there. And then again, with like certain climbs, say you're having a big climb at the start, you want to take as little with you because you know that you've maybe got a feed at the top. So taking something slightly more at the start, and then you try and have one drink or something that's got a bit in there. You know, it's almost like looking at the demands of the day and the immediate demands, and then forward planning around it.
To fuel your ride, go to scienceinsport.com.
Non è il primo cane che vediamo libero in giro in mezzo al gruppo. Questo è un problema che secondo me va risolto, ma non è facile risolverlo.
Ti riferisci solo in questa tappa o era già successo?
No, era già successo. È già successo anche le tappe scorse che abbiamo trovato qualche cane in mezzo alle strade. Però
quindi, sì.
È brutto cadere così, però dai.
Well, Brian, that voice belonged to Davide Ballerini. I said that Quickstep, or I think we alluded to the fact that Quickstep weren't commenting. We heard Phil Lowe, their spokesperson, say that they weren't going to comment tonight. Davide Ballerini did say a few things. He, of course, was the rider who caused the crash inadvertently, with the dog caused the crash. Ballerini then crashed. And what he was saying there to Ciro and me and a couple of others was that it wasn't the first dog they've seen stray dog or loose dog. They've seen the middle of the peloton over the last few days. He said it's a problem that needs to be fixed, but it's not easy to fix. But of course, it's not pleasant to crash like that, he said, but Remco seems okay. I was a bit shell-shocked because I caused him to crash. I hit the dog, slid, then it was a domino effect behind me. But let's see. So that was the first crash. Now, on Twitter, if you'll indulge me for a minute, Brian, I noticed the parallel between this and an infamous crash in the Giro d'Italia on the Valico di Chiunci, close to here in 1997. The victim on that occasion, and actually the peloton is going to go over the Valico di Chiunci tomorrow. The victim on that occasion was Marco Pantani. He had crashed in Milano-Torino in 1995, looked as though his career might be over, but he did come back in 96. And then at the 97 Giro, he had high hopes. Stage 8 was to Cava dei Tirreni. Where we're staying tonight. And what happened? Well, a cat... At the time, it was said it was a black cat, which is very unlucky in Italy.
Well, and also in southern Italy, they're so superstitious.
Exactly. Other outlets said it was a grey cat. Felice Puttini, the Swiss rider, apparently hit it and then brought down Pantani behind him. Pantani there was sort of, well, pushed, cajoled to the finish line by his teammates, riders like Gianni Bugno. Anyway, our good friend Lizzie Banks, host of the cycling podcast Femina, and, well, sometime host of the Femina, and also service course, she asked me whether we knew what happened to the cat. Well, let me tell you, Brian, I do know what happened to the cat. And the cat was called Puffy.
You have my attention now.
Yeah, the cat was called Puffy. It was a Siamese cat, and sadly, and I'm not being facetious here because I'm a cat lover as well, it died a few days later. How do I know this? Because in March, in the town where it occurred, Tramonti, a plaque was unveiled in homage to the incident on Pantani, one of what must now be hundreds of Pantani monuments and plaques scattered throughout Italy. The inauguration was attended by Gianni Bugno.
So it wasn't for the cat?
No, it's the picture you'll see there, if we go there tomorrow, is Pantani, not the cat, not Puffy. Gianni Bugno went to the ceremony because he was one of the ones, as I said, who tried to sort of push Pantani to the finish line that day. Pantani did pull out of that Giro. And who else was there? Well, the owner of the cat, the owner of Puffy, Danilo Amato, was 9 years old at the time in 1997. Nowadays, he works for an energy company, and in his spare time, he volunteers and works on the maintenance and restoration of trekking paths on the Amalfi Coast, where we'll be tomorrow. And he said that after the crash, after the incident, the local community turned on him and his family. They said they should have been taking better care of their cat and they shouldn't have let it out on the road. And this was unfortunate, ironic, because he and his family were big Pantani fans. Another footnote, small footnote, if you'll indulge me for just a few more seconds, Brian.
You're into 10 minutes about this now.
I said this was in a place called Tramonti. Well, Tramonti's claims to fame include having been the birthplace of pizza. Now, yeah, I think you probably know what's coming. We've talked a lot about the origins of Italian delicacies in the last few days.
There are none.
In my podcast, Imbroglio, the other day, which featured Alberto Grandi, the professor, the Italian food heretic from the University of Parma. Well, I put this to Alberto this afternoon. Could Tramonti really have been the place where pizza was born in, they claim, or there are claims on various websites, the Middle Ages? Alberto replied, "Are you joking? Tramonti was a microscopic place back then."
It's not like a pizza takes up a lot of space.
Pizza was if pizza was made there, it was made in the same way as it was everywhere else on the Mediterranean. They certainly didn't put mozzarella on it, or pomodoro, or tomato. They were ingredients that were only added in the 20th century. In Napoli and the rest of Campania.
I think you should. I'm not taking you to Naples, to Napoli tomorrow, with you having that conversation with anyone. If you ask that question in a pizzeria or state that claim, I'm gonna have to disassociate myself,
Brian,
from you.
I think
it's too dangerous.
Before I embarked on that very long and meandering parenthesis, I think we were in 2023 and we were talking about Remco Evenepoel's crash. First crash today, and dogs on the course. I suppose the key question, being serious for a moment, not that we were being facetious earlier, was based on what we saw, how is it going to affect Remco, all of this? Based on what we know, we don't know much, but based on what we do know and what we saw, how is it going to affect him?
I mean, the worst case scenario is that he's broken something, but it certainly doesn't look like it. And, you know, like you mentioned, you saw him at the bus, he had a debrief with his coach and everything. So I doubt that's the case. But no one crashes twice without it being feeling quite stiff the day after. I mean, they probably have a pretty intense evening in front of them once they've confirmed that he's okay and just, you know, structurally with his bones and everything. But you stiffen up a lot, you know. These are not warm stages either, you know. It's cold, and it, the tough thing about crashing when you're a GC rider is you can't go out next day and be overcautious. You'll stiffen up on the bike, you'll lose your competitive edge in some of those situations. And these next stages, especially tomorrow, you know, after that we go into the high mountains down here. But tomorrow is a really tricky stage, and tomorrow with the weather being like this, it's potentially even more dangerous, in my opinion. So it's tough. But it's kind of the name of the game in these races. And unfortunately, here where, you know, not all the roads are that well maintained, and there could be oil spills and various things that just make it a lot more dangerous. And I think, you know, if beer is slippery, any road in Naples is dangerous, because they've been partying their face off basically ever since they won the Scudetto last week.
And they will have been unsettled, won't they, Sudal Quickstep? I mean, they may already have felt a little unsettled yesterday when Ilan Van Wilder and Jan Hurt had a tricky day on the stage to Lago Lacino. We'll talk a bit more about that later.
Well, just briefly on that, we always say that, you know, there's accumulated fatigue and this Giro is difficult because it's hard from the beginning, but it's very hard for those domestiques as well. It's not like they have, you know, they can rest at any point on these stages. Every stage is a GC stage in that sense, and we saw that today. Some of them might actually work harder today than they would have on any other stage, because it's just absolute, every alarm bell rings once your leader is on the ground.
And Brian, Remco, we'll go back to Remco in a minute, but he wasn't the only person to crash, of course. Primoz Roglic also crashed. Now, I saw Primoz Roglic come into the bus compound, and he looked in pretty fine fettle. He was in good mood at the finish line. I know he spoke to a couple of journalists and said he was very relieved to get through. You know what I mean? And also, when he got to the bus paddock, as I say, he looked very limber, Brian. How do I know this? Because he went the wrong way to the bus paddock and he ended up behind some barriers and he simply vaulted over them, which was quite extraordinary. But he has also crashed. Let's not ignore that, and let's not forget that. If Remco is stiff tomorrow, then Primoz Roglic may also be stiff, and he may also be struggling. Who knows?
Well, I mean, if anything, if you can say anything about Roglic, it's like he's seen the ground from above before at very high speed, being a ski jumper. So maybe he has some techniques. I mean, boy, has he crashed a lot in various big races. But yeah, let's hope that all the favorites, any rider, and I'm also curious to hear if Mark Cavendish is okay tonight.
Well, Brian, I got a little bit of information from inside the Astana camp, shall we say. The word is that Cavendish has got a big cut on his leg, but might have a slightly sore knee, but he seems to be okay. Yes, it was carnage, wasn't it? I spoke to a couple of riders, a couple of people in teams who were very relieved that they were a long way behind the various pileups when they happened. And it's one of these days which sort of calls into question where it's best to be in the peloton. I mean, I think the whole peloton was braced for these stages to be treacherous when they saw the weather forecast. And you have to make a decision, don't you, about where you're going to be positioned in the peloton. On Rai television, on Italian television, they were sort of singing Remco's praises for having been at the front when that crash occurred, I think, with 7 kilometres to go. But he wasn't able to avoid the second one. And there is a large amount of luck involved, isn't there? Roglic was lucky that he had, I think it was Eduardo Affini, wasn't it?
Roglic was also lucky that a crash happened later on.
Yes.
Because it meant that, you know, there were riders waiting for Remco, there were other riders coming back. So,
and there aren't 10 very strong sprint trains in this Giro d'Italia.
No, not at all. And we saw that again today. It's been some rather gnarly finishes in that sense, and we haven't really seen strangely enough, the most normal sprint almost was the one that Jonathan Milan won, which wasn't by any means just, you know, standard a sprint to the finish line.
Brian, before we talk about Caden Groves, shall we have today's chiacchierata del giorno? Because it does relate to some of the topics we've already discussed. And it was with Jack Haig, who was one of the few riders to venture into the mixed zone this morning in a very wet Atripalla. So here's Jack Haig, Bahrain Victorious' leader, speaking to me this morning.
La chiacchierata del giorno. The team wag of the day.
Jack, you don't look thrilled about the weather.
Can you ask many riders this question? I'm pretty sure everyone will say the same thing. No, it's not great, and I think we might have a few more of these days coming up as well.
Just tell us about your Giro so far. You obviously lost those 19 seconds on the second day, but how are the legs?
Yesterday was nice to sort of get a bit of confidence. The last climb was not super hard, but we still had quite a small group at the finish there, and the feeling wasn't crazy hard for myself, so that was nice. Obviously the 19 seconds on the other sprint stage was a little bit annoying, and to be honest it's even more frustrating because when it doesn't really make sense from the organizers to narrow the road from 4 until 3 when we have a 3 kilometer rule, yeah, it's quite annoying. But yeah, it is how it is.
The new CPA president Adam Hansen has talked about the possibility of the 3K rule being extended to 5K. Do you have any strong feelings either way?
I think if it becomes 5 kilometers, it doesn't really change the situation. It only makes the time a bit better. I don't think there's anything that makes it worse to change it to 5 kilometers. And I'm not sure it will change too much, but there might be just a slight little bit of less stress inside the last 5 kilometers that happens. Because in the end, you still can't lose time. It's not as if you can sit up, but you can be a little bit more relaxed. Because you see it now, you get to 3 kilometers to go, and I think a lot of the GC riders breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. And if that happens at 5 kilometers to go, it's maybe a little bit better. Yeah, 5. And then maybe if there's special circumstances, the option to make it a little bit longer. Like, for example, today, we're going to have a narrowing from 4 until 3. Maybe let's have an option there that if there is something like this, that it can be extended 1 or 2 kilometers. So we start at 5, and then if there's something a little bit dangerous at 6 kilometers to go, then okay, let's look at trying to extend it to 6.
And just finally, tactically, Jack, yesterday UAE tried to attack Quickstep early. Were you surprised by that? Was it a good move?
To be honest, yesterday was a bit interesting. I'm not really sure what Quickstep were doing either, because in the end, they chased hard on the climb, and then they went quite hard on both downhills, and especially the second downhill, they went quite hard, and then they just stopped at the bottom to take off their clothes. So it was a little bit strange, but I think it put Quickstep under pressure quite a bit.
And well, Van Wilder struggled, Hurt struggled. I mean, how strong are they looking generally?
I think when it arrives to the proper mountain stages, and especially the final week, Remco might find himself quite isolated. And it was quite easy to see Ineos have by far the strongest team, by far. I think they had even Swift and Puccio at the bottom with like 20 kilometers to go yesterday. So that was more numbers than any other team had.
Well, Brian, first of all, I should apologise for the slightly substandard sound quality on that interview. Well, I should apologise on the Giro d'Italia's behalf and RCS, the organiser's behalf, for the very heavy bass in the mix zone this morning, which makes broadcast interviews pretty challenging, as you heard there. But some interesting points from Jack Haig in relation to the 3 kilometre rule, whether it should be extended. My fear is that then it becomes a bit of a movable feast, and you know, I could imagine a situation where it's 5 kilometres, but then on a particular day, a crash happens at 6 kilometres, and there is a groundswell of pressure and opinion from Direct Sportifs. They go to the commissaires, and it's sort of, it's changed and moved around on a bit of an ad hoc basis. Another interesting point Jack Haig made there, well, was about Remco's team, wasn't it? And the vulnerability that he has already seen, in Remco's team, which we all saw yesterday, didn't we?
Yeah, yesterday was very clear. And when I was seeing that yesterday, I thought that was quite worrying, because some of it could have been down to the fact that he had to chase back early in the race, you know, he was caught in the second half, and they had to burn some matches to bring him back. But if he's isolated that early compared to the other favourites teams, and some of them have two cards to play in the final, I think he's inclined to if they corner him when he's isolated, I think he's inclined to attack, and he might actually have to do that earlier than he wanted to, And with that, I mean, if Remco has to go out and attack to defend on Gran Sasso, which is the day after tomorrow, the long, long climb, where I doubt he'll have any teammates at the end, he'll gain time, but he will also have to worry about the rest of the race. How, you know, how is he going to defend the jersey if he gets it back? I'm pretty certain he'll get it back no later than the TT, because that TT is so long that he should be able to take away time from who's ever in front of him at that point, especially after the first big mountain stage. So it is quite worrying, but it's also great for the race, because you look at Remco and he's the outright favorite. He's stronger in every discipline than most of the others, and this issue with his team is the one thing that could save the excitement of the race, whether we like it or not. Because he's they're simply not good enough on the climbs. But he's had more use of them in other situations. He's lucky not to have a bunch of climbers on the stage like today, or potentially tomorrow, where they have to protect him on not flat roads, but in dangerous, almost classic type situations.
Yeah, you just wonder about how well some of those guys are actually going. Guys like Cataneo, who at his best is a top 10 rider in the Tour de France, or the fringes of the top 10 in the Tour de France. Van Wilde, at his best, is of a similar standard. Favecca as well, but a couple of them don't look as though they're in the best form. Jan Hirt, we mentioned, struggled in the conditions yesterday, with the conditions yesterday. So that is a little bit of a concern.
I think that's one of the reasons why Lefebvre's been bad-mouthing Alaphilippe, because he'd probably rather see him go to another team and free up some budget to get himself some serious help.
This was a theme, supposedly, around about Vuelta time last year, the end of the Vuelta, when Remco... it was clear that Remco was going to win the Vuelta, and there were already conversations about who was coming, who were they going to reinforce the team with. They added a couple of riders, but it still looks a little bit inexperienced and brittle in some respects. Brian, we should just talk about the stage winner, Caden Groves. When he left what is now Jayco Alula at the end of last year, there were a few who expressed some confusion, bewilderment, because he was going to a team that was stacked with fast riders. Philipsen, Malia left at the end of last year, but they've got other options as well. And the reason that he cited for leaving Jayco was that he wanted opportunities. And, well, he has been vindicated, hasn't he? And he looks not only very fast on flat finishes like today's, but he's impressed a lot of people with his climbing ability, which sort of belies his build, because if you were to look at him, you would say that is a guy, it's a classic sprinter who will struggle to get over a motorway bridge. But that's not the case, by no means.
I mean, he's not a Jonathan Milan, but no one but Jonathan Milan is.
I like his way of... I heard today, Brian, might be going to... Well, I think he's leaving Bahrain victorious at the end of the year. And I think he might end up at Trek Segafredo. But well, no, that's just a tip from me. That's just a prediction.
Good for Caden Groves. He's not going where he is. That would destroy the point we just tried to establish. I like Caden Groves' style of sprinting. I like how he positions himself in those finals. He's a smart rider. And he's not a super sprinter. He's not his top speed that wins, at least not yet, wins in those races. It's his, today, he was super well positioned. He took... With nothing illegal in what he did, how he boxed in Mads Pedersen, he just seems to like get it right, and I'm really impressed with him. And there's a lot of similar sprinters around, and it's also in a Giro like this where there aren't any super sprinters. I don't think we can say Gaviria's is a super sprinter that can just outsprint anyone.
He crashed, didn't he, today?
He crashed today as well. So it's and don't forget that they are now a World Tour team. So they have to ride the three Grand Tours, and they need a pretty flexible lineup for all those three. So I think he's obviously made a wise choice, because he has the team support.
Brian, let's wind back the clock a little bit earlier than usual in the episodes. Let's go back to around about lunchtime and my traditional cappuccino break with none other than Lionel Burney.
It's past 11, time for my cappuccino break.
La pausa cappuccino con Lionel Burney, dopo le 11.
Lionel, no Italian today.
No Italian today, no. Why would
today.
We?
It's Watford kind of weather.
It is. So Steady now.
Watford kind of weather for the next 10 days, very alarming, very concerning.
Wetford. Watford.
Yes, Watford. Rai Television, the Italian state broadcaster that shows the race every day here. I mean, they dedicated about 15 minutes earlier to talking about the evolution of the weather conditions over the next 10 days. And there might be a little bit of sun tomorrow and on a few other days, but generally it's looking bleak, very bleak.
Yeah, everybody in their wet weather gear. Basically, the peloton, two-thirds of it wearing black jerseys by the looks of it today, including Remco Evenepoel, who is getting to wear the rainbow bands, but not the proper white world champions jersey with the rainbow bands. Instead, a black rain jacket with the rainbow bands.
Was he inviting misfortune, tempting fate by wearing the black jersey in a race where, of course, the last ride on general classification used to be denoted by a black jersey?
Indeed. Well, there's about 75 black jerseys I can see on the screen at the moment as they head to the finish. I've got a really important question for you, Daniel, arising from yesterday's podcast when you were speaking to Larry Warbass of AG2R Citroën. Yes. We heard Mark Cavendish ride past and shout at the pair of you, but I couldn't make out what he was shouting, and a few listeners have asked, do you know, is it repeatable?
Well, it was something about a crash, and I tell you what, if you can wait a few more minutes, we'll have the answer, or a form, an answer of sorts to that question in today's instalment of Larenzando.
Excellent stuff.
Sticking
with AG2R Citroën, obviously they had a great day yesterday, Aurelien Paré-Peintre winning the stage for them, but they also lost a rider, Paul Lapera, who was in fact in the break on stage two and wore the King of the Mountains jersey for a day as a result of that breakaway. Lapera out feeling unwell, possibly weather-related. I mean, the wet weather, cold conditions will add another layer of hazard for the riders to deal with. And, more riders pulling out. Valerio Conti was a non-starter this morning as well, wasn't he? So the Giro is beginning to shed riders as the first week reaches its kind of middle point. Wednesday is hump day, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and I feel the mood is generally quite down in the peloton. I think everyone is slightly depressed about the weather forecast in particular, especially when they look ahead, as I said, to what's coming, what they've got coming over the next few days. There are a few long faces this morning at the start in Tripalda.
Yeah, not surprising. It's a one-off day of bad weather, fine, but when it sets in like it's forecast to do, it does lead to a bit of a grey spectacle when really we associate the Giro with that kind of vibrancy that we've talked about earlier on in the race. But the listeners are not downbeat. They're enjoying the racing. Some lovely feedback for your first episode of Kilometre Zero, Daniel. Somebody called Viltrio posted an acronym which stands for Yet Another Time the Cycling Podcast Explains Italy Better Than Italians Do, which I thought was nice.
I'm not sure about that, but we're going to debunk another myth with Alberto Grandi later in today's episode, actually, and it relates to Marco Pantani very tenuously. Anyway, that's very nice to hear. Thank you for that.
The second episode of Kilometre Zero went out this morning for friends of the podcast. It's with Koen Pelgrim, the man who is behind Remco Evenepoel, basically his coach at Soudal Quickstep. And a very interesting listen as well. But we've also had a question from a listener. Scott Jeffrey has travelled all the way from Perth, I'm assuming in Australia rather than Perth in Scotland, but either way, made a long or a very long trip to see the Giro d'Italia. He says it's the first time ever at a bike race. Wondering if you've got any tips for a spectator. He's going to be in Napoli tomorrow for stage six. Well, my advice to anyone watching a bike race is always to see it well once, and when the stage start and finish are in the same town as they are in Napoli, it gives a great opportunity to go and have a look around the team bus area, spot lots of riders, go away and have a nice lunch, find a bar with the race on the TV, and then come back down to the finish. And you've got plenty of time, Scott, to work out the logistics for that. Alternatively, go and find a climb. There's a climb just before Sorrento tomorrow's stage, and this advice really goes for anyone who's going off to watch a stage of a Grand Tour. My especially the first time, my advice is always to have one really good, memorable sight of the race. So hopefully, Scott, you'll enjoy your day in Napoli tomorrow.
Yes, Lionel, I would echo all of that. Various different ways to skin this particular cat. Lots of feline references in today's pod. I know animal references. But if he's a football fan, for example, might be an idea to be in Naples, still celebrating Lo Scudetto, the football league title that was won at the weekend. Football fever is still very much gripping Napoli. So if he heads into the Quartieri Spagnoli, that's probably going to be the hub of celebrations that's still going on. Could have a pizza, or if he's on a climb, try to find a restaurant or a bar where they're showing the race as well that he can duck into, because he might need some shelter tomorrow. There could definitely be some showers. But I'm sure we'll have a good day, as we will, Lionel.
Oh, well, I hope so. Yeah, I should just say, I mean, the Cycling Podcast does not condone or encourage the skinning of cats. You know, we got in trouble once for feeding cats crisps. I mean, that's bad enough. So, it's just a metaphor, isn't it, Daniel? Just a metaphor.
It is.
Well, yeah, have a great day, the pair of you.
Lionel, we'll catch up tomorrow.
Indeed.
Thanks a lot.
Well, Brian, we touched there, or I touched with Lionel, on Larry Warbass's, well, him being heckled by Mark Cavendish at the finish yesterday. And I promised some form of explanation. Well, that gives us the perfect prompt for today's installment of L'Arranzando. Take it away, Larry.
L'Arranzando, a postcard from Italy with Larry Warbass.
Larry, over there I can see your nemesis, Mark Cavendish, who accused you of causing a crash yesterday. What was all that about? Was there a crash yesterday?
No. He just likes messing with me. So he's always yelling at me in the peloton just for good fun. So it's funny, you know.
The larks you guys get up to. How were the celebrations last night?
They were calm. So, you know, I mean, it was cool. We were really happy for Aurelian. But, yeah, we didn't do any crazy celebrating, that's for sure.
How would you characterize the generally celebrations in French teams compared to the other teams you've been in?
I mean, it's all pretty much the same now.
No.
I think they're pretty happy, and you know, a little chica chica cheek thing, some yelling, and yeah, that's it. But you know, maybe a little speech, same like every team.
Well, Larry, you've got to get to work in a second, but just sum up the mood on the bus this morning, seeing the weather and knowing how difficult this start is going to be.
Yeah, it looks like a better stage for Fish than for us, but, you know, everyone knows, like, it's the same for everyone, so should be fine.
There's a very famous Italian pop group called the Nuclear Tactical Penguins, so they were playing it a minute ago. It's weather for penguins, isn't it?
It is weather for penguins, yeah.
La tappa di domani e la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Well, Brian, I alluded to our dinner last night, the two-page water menu. There was foam involved. It's always a worrying sign when you see foam, anything with foam on it on the menu. There were tasting menus, and the food was good. The service was not quite as efficient.
I mean,
as
we were basically outnumbered by staff.
Yes,
and that's generally a worry when you're, at least for them, it should be. Yeah, it's just.
Can you remember what you had?
We had
hazelnut and lentil,
which was really nice.
Amuse-bouche.
Yeah, that was really nice.
And which was good.
I had a starter with the calamari.
We were told we were very hungry last night, very, very hungry, and it was quite late.
We were hangry at this point, I think.
And as we waited for our drinks, we also asked whether we could have some bread, and we were told that the chef interpreted bread as something that was to be eaten with the first course.
And you couldn't have it.
They were the exact words. Yeah. And we informed the staff that we interpreted bread in a different way.
Yeah.
Which was the cause of some mirth. Yes, but Brian, it was an interesting experience.
I mean, it was interesting also for me because we stayed at a winery, San Gregorio, which is a huge part of the wine production here in this area. I'm not going to bore you with all the details. I probably did last night, but so that was interesting. But I'm looking forward to tonight, where I have a feeling we'll
something
have something
heartier,
a bit
Brian.
More. Yeah, exactly.
Something
exactly.
Much
also,
more.
Like with this weather, you need something a little more comfort food.
Definitely, and we had some comfort food at lunchtime. We had a lovely pizza. We're in Pizza Country now. Probably more talk about that tomorrow.
Careful.
We had some fritto, misto, lots of fried food at lunchtime as well. Brian, let's talk about Naples tomorrow. Before we do, should we talk about Naples, the city, briefly?
Yes.
Let's hear from none other than, well, who else? But
Naples' favourite son.
Another favourite son. There's always a favourite son in every episode of the podcast. This one's Naples' favourite son. It's Ciro Scognamiglio. Now, I spoke to Ciro yesterday about what it means to be Neapolitan and the sense one has of one's own identity when one grows up in Naples. So we're going to hear Ciro talking about maybe a slightly stereotyped image of Naples and the way that follows you around Italy. If you are from Naples. And then we're going to hear from John Foote, our friend, our cultural guru, author of multiple books about Italy, about the changing face of Naples.
Because Naples gives in both directions, really strong emotions to everyone. I understood immediately, when a person comes to Italy and to Naples, can love Naples for a lot of beauties and for a lot of reasons, but can also hate Naples for the problems that are in the city. But it's difficult that you find a person that saw Naples in his life and it doesn't feel anything inside him. So it's a kind of mixtures of sensations.
Yeah, I think that Neapolitan Renaissance, which kind of started in the 90s, and there was a lot of talk about it. There's quite a lot of criticism about this idea, because wasn't Napoli really changing? There's still large pockets of poverty and quite striking pockets of poverty. But certainly the Renaissance of that city is quite extraordinary, I think. For example, the building of a underground line with very striking architecture and artworks. It's become this, I mean, it always was a tourist destination, but it's become this kind of obligatory place on the map, you know, kind of added to Venice, Rome, the Venice, Rome, Florence axis. Mm. And I think that a lot of that is actually, quite strangely, the novels of Elena Ferrante, which have really, you know, have been read around the world, and the TV program that's made out of that, and also bizarrely Gomorrah. I mean, there have been a lot of TV which you wouldn't think would make you want to go to Naples, but there you go. But Ferrante, certainly people kind of go to Naples thinking they're going to find that Naples, which is a very kind of authentically, that might lead us to one of our later questions, authentic Italian experience. So it's become this huge tourist destination. I think a lot of money has come in that way. The city's been kind of cleaned up for tourists, and has made, and I think that it's a much easier city to visit than it was 20, 30 years ago, much more at peace with tourism and that kind of, and also other kinds of economic change, I think, have been really interesting over the last 10, 15 years, even cycle lanes.
Well, Brian, that's Naples. A couple of teasers there for Kilometre Zero that we're going to work on tomorrow live in the city. Of course, football fever in Naples at the moment, because the football team has just won Lo Scudetto. Lots going on in Naples, and we are going to be in the thick of it. We're going to be right in the guts of Naples tomorrow, aren't we? And we will report back in a Kilometre Zero and in the episode tomorrow. But what about the stage itself? Tell us about that. What do we got in store?
We have a fantastic stage in store, stage 6 tomorrow. Napoli to Napoli. It's not Naples, it's Napoli. 162 kilometers, fairly lumpy stage, especially at the start, and it features some of the most iconic sites of this big, brawling Italian, southern Italian city, including an initial loop around the eastern side of the Vesuvio volcano, which is, I think, sort of one of the most iconic sites of Naples. And it's a very active volcano, and it's a very dangerous place in the world, because all the people living around it could go off anywhere, at any time. Let's not hope tomorrow. We pass San Marzano, which is famous for
tomatoes.
Exactly. Pompeii, the Roman gates of Herculanum, and then onwards towards the scenic roads of the Amalfi and Positano coastline. But before the riders, they have to climb the Category 2 climb, the Valle Curi Chunsi, that you mentioned earlier.
And they're going the same way, incidentally, as they did in 1997. So look out for that descent. Look out for cats on the descent.
And the last climb is the Picco Sant'Angelo. And actually, if you look closely tomorrow, you'll see they'll probably ride past the very famous San Pietro Hotel, which is one of the iconic hotels on the on the Sorrento Peninsula. So once they're done with that and they pass Sorrento, which, and I feel like this, the cycling podcast has become one big corrections corner of where things actually stem from. But it is, for me at least, the spiritual home of Limoncello. Then the stage returns towards...
Paging Alberto Grandi,
yeah,
as we speak.
Oh, yeah. Like, so the stage returns towards Naples via the coast and the western side of Vesuvio. The run into the finish should be fairly straightforward. Having said that, we saw today it doesn't take much for panic to arise. There are actually a few hard corners in the last 3 kilometers, but after the Flamme Rouge, fingers crossed, it should be a fairly straightforward deal and either sprint to the line or a group sprint in a breakaway. We'll see.
Brian, well, you say it's going to be a break. I mean, what do you think? What's your best guess as to what is going to happen tomorrow?
I think it's a lot is down to how some of those riders who crashed today are going. Mads Pedersen was third today. He is very, very keen to win a stage. If he's okay, and you know, he didn't go down, and he's probably very hungry after a stage win, there's a good chance that Trek Segafredo will take some kind of responsibility. However, and it's a very long time since there's been a successful breakaway in that sense, there's a lot of riders who want to go into a breakaway. And tomorrow, because the main difficulties are somewhat early on the stage, there'll be a lot of attacking. And I think we'll still, see who's licking their wounds after today. It's been a hard Giro just for the sake of, you know, people actually trying to get over crashes and get back into being competitive.
What do we expect from the Maglia Rosa and his team, DSM, tomorrow? Do we expect them to try and control things, or is tomorrow a dangerous day for them?
Well, I think that if they lose the jersey tomorrow, it's still been a good run for them with 2 days. But I think the level of difficulty on the stage should be okay for them. Having said that, I don't think they want to control all day. I don't think they're strong enough to do that. So maybe they'll, as they did today also, they'll chip in a few riders to, you know, the teams who want to keep things together. If it's as rainy tomorrow as it is today, it's going to be super dangerous. And sometimes just the thought of it being dangerous makes it dangerous in itself, because the riders are nervous, positioning, all the DSs are telling the riders to get to the front. So sometimes there's no way around it, but it often can cause crashes, that there is an imminent risk for crashes. So that's unfortunately the mechanism of Grand Tour racing, when every day is a GC day on even semi-difficult stages.
Brian, we're going to head off to Cava dei Tirreni. We are going to sympathise with our Belgian colleagues who might have a long night in store. We were hoping that we might be joined by Renard Schotter, our friend from Sportser, this evening. We're just sitting outside the press room at a bar, and we thought we'd see Renard scurrying back to the press room to file his stories.
Well, Renard is what Ciro was to Vincenzo Nibali.
Yes.
So wherever Remco goes, Renard goes.
Exactly. So Renard might be at hospital right now. Some of the Belgians, we talked about this Belgian invasion of our colleagues at the Giro d'Italia this year because of Remco, and there were murmurs among them this afternoon that they were going to try and track down the dog, the offending dog.
Oh God!
It's a long journey back to wherever it was. It's a relatively long journey.
I mean, just in the
same
start.
Yeah, in the same way that the poor, the
Puffy
lamented, much lamented, mourned Puffy was tracked down years later. I don't know if any of them are going to do that, but nothing really would surprise me. Their appetite for Remco stories, Remco news, knows no bounds.
Well, they also know that, you know, if Remco goes back to Belgium, so
home.
Do they.
They're on the first flight. Yeah. So, Brian, we're out of here as well. We're going to head off to our hotel.
And we'll stay regardless.
And we will stay. We'll be here to the bitter, bitter end. Brian, buona sera to all the listeners.
Buona sera.
We'll see you all tomorrow.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.